Hey there, my name is Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman, the podcast where we dive deep with the minds behind the sound. And today we are joined by a true pioneer in audio research, Dr. Sean Olive, for his fourth guest appearance on Audio Talks. Sean was on the first edition ever, just over 5 years ago, which makes him our longest running guest ever. Sean is a former senior fellow at Harman International and former president of the Audio Engineering Society. His groundbreaking work, especially on the Harman curve, has not only advanced Harman's product excellence from JBL to AKG, but has also elevated the entire industry's understanding of sound quality. Sean's research into listener preferences, headphone equalization, and predictive modeling of sound quality has helped to bridge the gap between subjective listening experiences and objective acoustic measurements. Today, we're going to talk about Sean's journey into audio, his research into how we hear and prefer sound, and where he thinks audio technology is heading next. Welcome back to the podcast, Sean. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Listen, let's jump right into it. So your record-breaking fourth appearance on the podcast, longest-running podcast guest ever, and you have the mother of all backstories. It's fascinating for our listeners who are so interested and passionate about sound. So let's dive in and start at the beginning. What was it that first sparked your interest in audio and acoustics? Like, was there any kind of defining moment or an early influence that set you on this path?
I think it started, I was a music student studying music at the University of Toronto. By luck, I moved into a residence with 60 other guys, and most of them were engineers. And back in this day, it was probably 1978. There was a real passion for audio, and a lot of the engineers built their sound systems. So listening to audio and talking about amplifiers and transistors was common talk. In my second year, I had to get myself a stereo system because the first year you share your room with someone and they had a stereo system. So I started researching audio and audio systems. That naturally led to an interest in the recordings because I noticed, well, these speakers sound good, but they vary depending on which recording I choose. So that led to an interest in sound recording. From there, I became interested in monitoring loudspeakers and how the speakers affect the sound. And I essentially went through what Floyd Toole, who was my mentor, describes as audio circle of confusion. And it's basically throughout the audio chain, you have music production, then you capture it with microphones, and then you reproduce it through loudspeakers. And all of these factors interact with each other. And if you don't have a good control of each part of the chain, it can affect your perception of how good something sounds. So, you know, the solution is science and measurements. And if you know how good the speaker is, then you can have confidence when you're making the recordings and choosing your microphones. Of course, the musician is the most important thing. They have to produce good sound. But I essentially followed my way through that whole circle, ended up in the last part of the chain, the sound reproduction.
Fantastic. Yes, and you dropped a very significant name there, Floyd Toole, a name well known to lovers of great audio, such an OG, and it's incredible that you're working together back in the day and he was mentoring those early steps. But can you talk a little bit about your academic journey and how it actually went on to shape your career direction?
Yeah, well, like I said, I started out studying music at the University of Toronto. I played the piano. I developed an interest in audio. I think the final straw for me changing fields was I remember doing an orchestration in jazz and it was recorded by the jazz orchestra. And when I got the recording, it was really disappointing. It didn't sound like anything I had written. The final straw was my final year. I did a piano recital. And when I got home, I listened to the cassette and it was just boom, boom, boom. And it turned out the technician had put two microphones underneath the piano. So it was primarily bass, and all the treble and mid-range that would be coming out the top of the piano was totally missing. So at that point, I said, I have to learn more about recording and improve the sound of music and how it's recorded. So I went off to McGill University, where they have a master's program. It's a Tonmeister program modeled after the German program, where you study music, you're a trained musician, and then you learn the art and science of recording music. So I recorded orchestras and jazz quartets and all kinds of different music. But one year, my final year, we went on a field trip to the National Research Council in Ottawa, where I met Floyd Toole. And he was doing all these cool experiments. I remember we sat in a room and we did a double-blind listening test of different loudspeakers. And we're describing the sound of each speaker. And for me, this was totally fascinating, how you could apply a science to something that seems so subjective, like sound quality. And yet you went through a series of trials, and it turns out that people were largely describing the same thing. You know, this was a class of maybe four students. And then he took us into the anechoic chamber, where he measured these speakers, and you could see these visual correlations between how flat and smooth the speakers are and what listeners' impressions were. So that just blew me away, because the missing part of the whole recording process was that we were assuming these speakers we were monitoring through were really accurate. And I learned that's not always the case. So I ended up going back and doing a summer internship, and at the same time hoping to write my master's thesis. I was doing a series of experiments there, and I was supposed to go off and be graduate and be a recording engineer, but I was so enamored with this whole process, I spent 7 years there doing research.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. So we actually have the gentleman with the two falsely placed mics. We have to thank him for a lot for getting the recording completely wrong there and inspiring you to actually make recordings better and understand how they work, how people respond to audio, and what actually makes good sound. But let's jump forward in time a bit, because I'm really curious to know about your time at the Audio Engineering Society. So I suspect that most people listening to this podcast will know exactly who the AES is, and you've been deeply involved with them, including serving as its president. So what drew you to the society originally?
Yeah, I mean, I was a student in Montreal, and I remember a friend of mine, we took the all-night bus down to New York, where we experienced our first convention. And it was in the Hilton Hotel in New York, so it was quite small, but very vibrant. And I met all these famous heavyweights. I went to a few lectures and didn't understand half of what they were talking about. It seemed like a foreign language to me at the time, FFTs and all these formulas on the board. And I said, oh, maybe I'm not cut out for this field after all. But it was apparent that this is the society you belong to if you want to rub shoulders with all the influential people in academia, in sound recording, in the music industry. And to this day, that's still true. There's 13,000 professionals, and a lot of them are students and professors at various universities. And they're the only society dedicated to the arts and science of recording and sound reproduction. So it's the place to be if you want to do peer-reviewed research and just rub shoulders with people that are as passionate about the field as you are.
Yeah, well said. I absolutely love the AES. I love their work, and they publish such interesting white papers. They have great events. So listeners, if you're thinking of embarking along a similar path to the good Dr. Sean Olive, and you have not joined the AES, I think we can all recommend it here. But Sean, coming back to your role when you were president of the AES, you did a lot of things, like you championed higher standards in audio evaluation, and you really fostered a lot of collaboration between academia and industry. Can you talk to us a bit about some of your goals or, you know, main initiatives during your time as the president of the AES?
Yeah, every president has a different focus, but mine was, one of them was to try to increase or at least sustain our membership. And at the time, this was 2014, I had started to travel in China on behalf of Harman. We were setting up a factory in Suzhou, and we had an office in Shanghai. And I went to a conference there in Shenzhen and got invited to give a lecture at Nanjing University, where they have a very large audio acoustic program. And Harman actually hires many of the graduates of that program. So I thought through the AES and through my work, I could reach out to universities and various audio organizations there and try to get them to join the AES, because at that point, the biggest growth areas were, I think, in Asia and China. So that was one of my roles. The other role was something I'd been doing all along. I participated in technical committees. I was in one particular committee. I was the co-chair of perception and evaluation of audio signals. And that group basically focuses on raising the bar for how we evaluate and test sound quality and audio products. So, you know, we would organize workshops and tutorials and interface with universities and try to get them involved and try to raise the bar and the standards and how we do listening tests on audio products.
Mm. There's some pivotal work there. And my goodness, moving into China, not the smallest of countries there, and really seeing some of the great audio innovations that are coming out of that territory really is a testament to that whole initiative. It's fantastic. But looking back, now you've got a bit of perspective, how do you think this involvement with the AES influenced your own personal journey? What did it mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think my career would have nearly been as successful without the AES. It gave me connections and access to the smartest people involved in audio engineering. It gave me a forum to publish peer-reviewed research, so that helped give credibility and validation to the work that I was doing, both at the National Research Council and Harman. As I was clearing out my office a couple of weeks ago, I came across this nice letter that the former CEO, Dinesh Paliwal, wrote to me after I was elected president. And I realized at that point it had made a big impression on him. And shortly after, I was promoted to fellow and then senior fellow. So clearly, he recognized this as a great achievement. And I think it helped validate my importance to the industry by doing all that work with AES. So it was a good career move. I did it not for that reason, but in the end, it was helpful.
Is there one kind of pivotal moment or achievement or just moment in time from your tenure at AES that you're especially proud of?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was my work I did in China representing the AES.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was the first, but after I did that, many other presidents followed. And I think it was always important to go visit them because it was the missing link in the whole international society was having, you know, representation and a voice in China.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, shia for that, Sean. That is absolutely pivotal work, and it's has changed the world of audio as we know it. And it's a much more exciting and vibrant place with higher standards because of that specific work. Let's move on to another really fascinating chapter of your work and talk about your career at Harman and also the Harman sound curve. Now, you've had a very long and very influential career at Harman. Could you cast your mind back and tell us how did that opportunity actually come about?
Well, again, a lot of my career can be found through Floyd Toole. And in 1991, you know, at this point, he'd published these seminal papers in loudspeakers and listener preferences. So he was headhunted by Dr. Sidney Harman, the founder of Harman, to bring science into Harman product design and testing. So he was hired as a VP of corporate research. And 2 years later, I got a call to join him. And my title was Manager of Subjective Evaluation. So at this point in Harman, there were very few double-blind tests. So listening tests were rather casual affairs. How we measured speakers, we had anechoic chambers at that time, but some people measured them in rooms, some people measured them. There was no standard procedure. And Floyd had already established an approach to measure speakers that tended to correlate with listener preferences. So my job was to start doing listening tests on all of Harman products and benchmark them against competitors. So we built facilities. One of the most impressive facilities at the time, we built a room with an automated speaker shuffler.
Wow.
So you would set up 4 speakers, and when you switch speakers, it would nomadically move backwards and another one would come into place in a matter of 3 or 4 seconds. So this eliminated the positional biases. When you move a speaker around in the room, it'll couple with the room modes differently. It affects the bass. It also reflects the pattern of reflections, which affects the sound. So this was, I think, the industry's first automatic speaker shuffler. So people would come in, there'd be a curtain. They weren't aware of what was behind the curtain, and they would go through a series of trials and give ratings for each speaker. that was a very serious activity for a number of years because every product we made would go through that process.
Mm.
And slowly, Harman and the engineers became confident of the results, and they started to develop confidence in the measurements and what they mean in terms of sound quality. Then the professional speakers started to go through there, and then eventually we got involved in car audio and more recently headphones.
I mean, I love the job title, the Manager of Subjective Evaluation. I'm going to head along to Primavera Sound this week in Barcelona. And when I'm doing some people watching, I'll say, yes, I'm just here as a Manager of Subjective Evaluation. So let's see how that goes. But listen, let's move on to the Harman Curve. Now, this is a really revolutionary thing. This has been described in many places as a gift to the entire industry of audio. And it has become the benchmark in headphone tuning. So could you give us like a one-line definition of this and also walk us through how that research began that made the Harman Curve what it is today.
Yeah, so the Harman Curve is simply a preferred frequency response measured on a standard test fixture that most people like. We tested hundreds and hundreds of people, and we found that on average about 64% of the people will prefer this frequency response, and there's two other smaller segments that prefer slight modifications to the bass or treble, but that essentially is what it is.
Wow, two out of three cats can't be wrong. That's tremendous. And how did you actually kind of go about this enormous research project? You're talking about hundreds and hundreds of different sets of headphones and measurement and digesting all of the data. How did it actually come to fruition?
Yeah, so the research began around 2012, and it came out of a need to support Harman's growing headphone business, because at that time, our business was mostly professional headphones under the AKG brand, but JBL and Harman Kardon saw opportunities. So Todd Welty, a colleague of mine, we started testing headphones, and we found there was really no consistency or consensus of how it should sound or measure. Headphones were all over the map. We looked at the international headphone standards, and the current standard at that time was a diffuse field calibrated headphone, and we found that hardly anyone was following the standard. So we thought, here's an opportunity to apply science to figure out what it is people like. Do they agree? And then is there a measurement that describes what they like or prefer? And, you know, we knew from all of our loudspeaker research that, you know, it was possible to do this. Why should it be any different with headphones? Mm. So we started to conduct listening tests. We decided that we would start off measuring what we know people like in terms of a loudspeaker. We took a flat loudspeaker, we put it in our reference listening room, and we measured at the eardrum what the response was. And that sort of became our baseline target. We had people do adjustments to the bass and the treble, and they tended to converge on this target that was largely similar to a good speaker in a room. We then tested it with hundreds of people all over the world. We went to Germany, Canada, US, China, and people generally agreed, and it was true whether they were trained listeners or untrained listeners. The untrained listeners just tended to have more variation in their responses. They weren't as discriminating, but the overall trends were very much the same. That became the Harman target curve.
It's a huge piece of work, and really, it was a blank canvas. And as you say, they were using the diffuse method of alignment, but not many people were using it. So you really had to write the book on this. Could you take us through some of the biggest challenges, or if there were any surprises in developing this definitive Harman curve?
Yeah, I mean, the first challenge was, how do you do a double-blind test with a headphone? Yeah. Double-blind test means you're not aware of the model or the brand. You don't know how much it costs. This is easy to do with speakers because you just hide them behind a curtain. And if you have a speaker shuffler, you can quickly switch between the speakers and everything's great. So the very first test we did, we would have someone come into the listening room, and the test administrator would substitute the headphones from behind. So the listener wasn't aware of the brand or how it looked. But after a while, we realized that people could identify the headphone just by its weight or how it felt. There was one particular headphone that was very heavy, and they could identify the headphone strictly by its weight and feel. So wow. It was no longer a blind test. So we had to come up with a better method. So we measured these headphones on our test fixture, and we found if we applied a digital filter to a single headphone and emulated these different headphones, you could put on a single headphone and virtualize all these other headphones. And it was essentially a blind test. You remove the identity of the product, and there were no weight issues. And we did a lot of work validating that the virtual headphones produce the same ratings as the actual headphones. So that was a major problem that we solved.
That's some ingenuity right there. Yeah, virtualizing the headphones really removes those kind of potentially misleading factors in the test. So that's fascinating. Wow. And once the Harman curve was released, how did the industry respond? Because I believe it had quite a significant impact.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough that there wasn't much published research. So what we were presenting was very new and novel. And there was a guy at a headphone review site called Inner Fidelity, and his name was Tyle Hertzens. He took an interest in our work and he started reporting it. And because he had thousands of headphone enthusiasts following him, it suddenly became very well known across the internet and among the headphone enthusiast community.
Kind of zooming out a bit, do you see through your testing and through your just involvement in the global audio industry and how it's evolved? I mean, Harman is today, I believe, the biggest manufacturer of headphones on the planet. Do you think that listener preferences are changing over time? And if so, does the Harman curve evolve with changing preferences, or what's your take on that?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think maybe music and musical tastes may change over time. And maybe how music is recorded has changed over time. We went through a period of loudness wars where the music was very dynamically compressed so that when it was played over radio or over iTunes playlists, the goal was to be the loudest song on the list. But that's even sort of changed and we're going back to more dynamic range. But to answer your question, you know, as long as you believe the role of the audio system is to faithfully reproduce the music as intended, then I would say, no, I don't think tastes or preferences in audio equipment in terms of sound is going to change. Now, we do know that sound quality tastes slightly change with age, but this has mostly to do with hearing loss and our perception of the relative balance of bass and treble. And you're already seeing products, particularly earbuds, are addressing this by having built-in capability to measure your hearing and then make compensation in terms of equalization and compression of dynamic range. So I think in terms of hearing loss, that type of product will be increasingly more common.
Fascinating. You know, we've kind of double-clicked on your time at the AES. We've had a deep dive into the world of Harman and the Harman curve. But let's zoom out and talk about the audio industry. Because in your time, in your illustrious career, you've witnessed massive changes in both the professional and consumer audio markets. Have there been any shifts that have surprised you the most?
Yeah, I don't know if this is a surprise. I guess it is because I've lived through some amazing technological changes in my lifetime, from analog to digital, from not having a computer until I went to NRC. So I experienced the computer revolution and now the digital audio revolution, and now it's AI and machine learning. But I think the biggest change came when we moved from analog to digital audio, which began in the 1980s with the introduction of the CD. When I arrived at NRC in 85, I mean, like I said, that was my first experience with a computer. I bought my first sound card. It was a Digitech, and I bought my first CD burner. You had to buy a 1 gig hard drive to hold an entire hour of CD music, and the cost of that hard drive was $1,000.
Madre mia.
You can now get 4 terabytes for $99. So
yeah,
that had a huge impact on audio because suddenly we had low-cost, powerful computing, DSP chips, and the internet, and it fundamentally changed the audio business. I mean, overnight, the professional audio business went from being large studios where you had racks of analog mixing consoles and equipment, and you paid hundreds of dollars an hour, to now something that can be done on your laptop in your bedroom with a couple of microphones.
Yeah.
So that was a big change. And I think similar disruptions occurred in consumer audio, where the content has moved from actually owning the media, CDs, tapes or whatever, to actually not owning and streaming it. So the analogy is when Netflix came out and it pretty well killed Blockbuster. So now we see in consumer that audio content can be consumed anywhere. This has driven the headphone business, now accounts for more sales than speakers in the consumer market.
Wow.
And now we have immersive audio, which I think may succeed. I've lived through many false starts with multi-channel audio in the 90s because we had different formats. You needed five speakers and all the electronics in order to enjoy it, but now it can be streamed and it's completely adapts to whatever system you have, whether it's headphones, two speakers, or a 9.1.4. So there's a likelihood that immersive audio will survive because it's adaptive to whatever system you have and you can listen to it anywhere.
Yeah, I absolutely feel your pain there. Talking about the cost of hard drives, I remember buying a paradigm-busting 512 megabytes optical hard drive back in the day to tour with some music. And I'm not even going to say how much that cost, dear listeners, because you just cry into your coffee right now. Let's move on. Let's draw a polite veil of history over that. So you've got a great perspective on many things. And if there was anybody I was going to ask the next question to, it would be you. So here we go. How has the balance between objective measurement and subjective listening changed over time from the Dr. Sean Olive perspective?
Yeah, I think it has changed as we've done more and more controlled listening tests. We've learned what matters most and what we can largely ignore. So, you know, at Harman, we're now at the point where we can get 90% or more, get our answers, is this product ready to ship? Just by measurements alone, because we can predict listeners' preferences with about 86 to 90% accuracy. And it's just that last 10% where you want to do a listening check and make sure there's no audible distortion, that there's something that the measurements aren't revealing. So I think with speakers and headphones now, we can get 90% of the way there. And it's only when there's question marks about perhaps distortion or spatial attributes that right now we're not there yet to be able to predict those attributes based on measurements alone. So I think that there's no reason why we can't if we do more research focused on those two attributes.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. Right, I'm going to ask you another kind of detailed question. I'd love to get your take on this. So have you noticed a kind of alignment or a widening gap between professional audio standards and consumer expectations? Are these lines that have been growing together or growing apart?
That's an interesting question. I think 20 years ago, people in the pro world would never consider purchasing or listening to a consumer speaker. But I think Floyd Toole, actually, back in the 1980s, he did comparisons of professional monitors versus some well-regarded consumer speakers. And he actually found that there was no correlation between price and sound quality. The professional monitors were much more expensive. But in terms of sound quality, the consumer speakers, they were better in sound quality at lower prices. And I think that can be attributed to that the professionals just weren't following the science. Now that's no longer the case. You can buy very good, affordable professional monitors like the JBL LSR series, the 306s, I think. They're just a few hundred dollars. You can buy a consumer speaker for that amount of money, and it's also very good. So I think there's no longer this huge gap between professional and consumer audio gear. And in terms of headphones, well, AKG, who make professional headphones like the K361, that's tuned to the Harman Targa curve. So if you buy, whether it's a JBL or an AKG professional headphones, they're almost identical in terms of how they measure and how they sound. And that's a good thing, because if they use that AKG headphone for recording and mastering music, then consumers can hear a similar experience over their JBL consumer headphone. And that's what solving the circle of confusion is all about.
I like it. So your career today started with the circle of confusion and ended up kind of resolving it and actually bringing these lines together and removing that chasm between what the consumers are experiencing and what the musicians wanted them to hear. This is a life in sound that has resulted in people actually hearing sound the way the musicians wanted it to be heard. So as life goals goes, that's pretty much right up there. That's phenomenal. But listen, you spoke earlier about spatial audio and we have all this cool new technology. So let's invite you to get your crystal ball out. So we've got AI, we've got machine learning, spatial audio, we've got immersive formats becoming more mainstream. How do you see these factors and these new technologies impacting audio quality and audio design?
Yeah, well, AI and machine learning has multiple uses in audio. It's being used to compose music right now. So that's one thing. In audio, we're starting to see it being used to build perceptual models, models based on patterns that can predict how good a headphone or a speaker or maybe a car audio system sounds. While I was at Harman, we've already had some success using it to predict listener preferences in cars based on measurements. That's a huge advantage because we evaluate over 200 cars a year and we do very rigorous listening tests with panels of 15 to 20 people per car. So if you can use AI to tune the car to get within that 90% and then run it through a listening test and get good correlations with listeners' preferences, that's a huge advantage. As cars become less and less available because manufacturers don't want to make prototypes, there's pressure to do everything in modeling and virtualization. So that's another potential application where you build and model the car on a computer, including the audio system, the acoustics, and then being able to predict it or even oralize it over headphones. That's always been the dream inside of Harman, and hopefully someday we're getting closer. In headphones now, there's a lab in Denmark called SenseLab that have a tool called Virtual Listening Panel where they make recordings of headphones, and using data from expert listeners, they can predict timbral aspects of the headphone just by using this AI model. In terms of immersive formats, we have Atmos, MPEG-H, DTS, and Samsung's new Eclipsa. So that's becoming, as I said, more and more prevalent in headphones, soundbars, car audio systems. So I think you're going to see, as there's wider adoption, systems will be designed to accommodate it. You know, I think the better systems will have the ability to adapt to the listener's anatomy. It may have their own individual HRTFs, which are these head-related transfer functions that carry all the important cues for where you localize sound and how immersive it is. So I see that playing a role. Of course, the more successful systems, the more they automatically configure and adapt to whatever the situation, the more successful they'll be. Right now, there's a lot of consumer, I think, hesitation to buy all these complicated multi-channel systems because of the complexity in setting it up and calibrating it. So the easier they are to use, I think, the more successful we'll see.
Yeah, I totally agree on your point there about the consumer attitude and kind of where they are in terms of the education and how the industry has to kind of walk alongside them and educate them and bring them on the same journey. So very good point there. But do you think that having solved basically this circle of confusion and always trying to reach the final boss level of pristine audio, do you think we're almost there, or is there actually always a bit more to travel on the journey?
I think sound quality is, I wouldn't say it's a commoditization yet, but I think it has improved over the years. And I think we have the knowledge and the technology to achieve it. It's just a matter of executing it. So what remains, I think, is audio that can adapt to the acoustics of your room or the space that you set it up, because we know that you can build the world's best speaker as soon as you stick it in a room. It interacts with the acoustics of the room. It can dramatically affect the bass. It enhances certain room modes. So systems that can be easily set up, adapt to the room acoustics, or in the case of headphones, how it couples to your head and your ears. Those are all problems, I think, that still need to be solved.
Excellent. And speaking of which, if you had absolutely unlimited resources to explore any audio-related research question, what would you focus on?
There's still a lot of questions about the limits of our perception and how certain variables affect our perception and our preferences. But I have this dream where I could build the audio equivalent of the Star Trek holodeck, where...
Please make it so.
You walk into a room and there's... Maybe you see nothing except some virtualization of some space. And the speakers are all hidden, but inside that room, you could basically virtualize or simulate any loudspeaker, any car, any headphone, and have complete control over it. You could switch between 30 or 40 different cars without moving, just spend a couple of years gathering information about the relationship between the simulation and what the listener is telling you. That, to me, would be me going to heaven.
Fantastic. Okay, it can only be improved if you actually operated it by making the live long and prosper hand gesture and you kind of steered it through that. I think that would be the icing on the holodeck cake there. But listen, so, you know, you've been very generous with your time now, and I realize that you have segued recently and announced your retirement after 32 incredible years of innovation and scientific excellence at Harman. So looking back on your career so far, is there one thing that you're the most proud of?
There's a lot of various things I'm proud of, but I'd have to say I'm surprised and pleased that we were able to elevate the standards and raise the bar of headphone sound quality. So all of the research that we did over a seven-year period, I think, helped raise the standards and the quality of headphones. And for that, I think I'm most proud.
Yeah, dead right. I mean, that was phenomenal work. I am wearing a beautiful pair of JBL headphones. I've got a pair of the AKG headphones that you mentioned earlier. And comparing this to some of the pairs of headphones I've had in the past, it's just a different world entirely. So thanks to you, and thank you to your team, and thanks for Harman for actually believing this and making it all happen with you and the team. It's just, it has been transformational for the industry. Absolutely no question there. So I think anybody listening to this on any pair of headphones anywhere in the world has a lot of your research to thank for that. So is there any advice, given what you know now, is there any advice that you would give to young engineers or researchers who are just starting out in audio? What would you recommend?
I would recommend that they follow what I did and join the AES as soon as they can. It's not expensive. As a student, it's almost the price of a 4 terabyte hard drive.
4 terabyte hard drive in 2025, not in like 1992. Yeah.
Yes. They'll meet a wide variety of people working in audio, so you get a flavor of what the different paths are. And then my second advice would be to get an internship at an audio company rather than invest years of going to school. Just experience what the work is like. The most successful hires I ever did while I was at Harman were people who were interns. And the ones that I made the most mistakes were people that were just hired fresh out of school. And they had no idea if they were well suited for the job. And we had no indication of whether they were as well. So it's a win-win situation if you can get an internship at an audio company.
Yeah, great point there. And just a little side note to our listeners is that it is worth following Harman on LinkedIn, because they do announce internships and opportunities to work with brands like JBL and AKG. So just a little pro tip for you there. And good luck on your travels, anyone who's just embarking on the journey. And of course, AES for the win, 100% there. I can't stress that enough. So Sean, are there any areas of audio that you still want to research or explore or contribute to in the coming years?
Yeah, I still have a passion about headphone research. There's some unresolved questions I'd like to address. I'm also interested in immersive audio, so I'm still not happy when I listen to immersive music through headphones. Mm. It's still largely inside my head or around my head, and I get a better experience when I hear it through speakers. So I think there's some challenges that can be solved. I still want to play a role in educating people about sound quality, so I'm not sure how I will do that, but those are some of the key things I'd like to pursue in the coming years.
Excellent. I'm very glad to hear that, and I'll be even more glad to hear the results when they're released. So what's next for you in the short term? Are you going to have a well-earned vacation, or have you got some projects lined up already?
Well, the first thing I did when I retired is I bought myself a brand new racing bike.
Oh, nice.
Always been passionate cyclist. Before I moved to California, I never owned a car. I cycled everywhere. And I'm looking to buy a piano, so I want to get back into playing the piano.
Excellent.
And apart from that, I'm getting a lot of texts and emails about potential consulting gigs. So we'll see how that pans out. But I'm really looking to focus on something that I'm passionate about, since I can choose now and be choosy and picky.
That is great. I'm very excited about the next stage of your career, Sean. That's excellent stuff. So if folks want to get in touch with you and have a chat, where can they find you? What are some of your recommended channels?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, on Facebook, and less active on X now, more active on Blue Sky. I also forgot to mention that Floyd Toole, Todd Welty, and I just finished a book on Focal Press. Yeah.
Amazing.
It's called Sound Reproduction, The Acoustics and Psychoacoustics of Loudspeakers, Headphones, and Rooms. Floyd has written three editions, and this fourth one brings the three of us back together, because we started out doing research together at Harman back in the 1990s. So this new book has a chapter on headphones that I wrote, and a chapter on subwoofer configurations and how you can control room modes to improve the sweet spot of the listening area that Todd wrote. It's out in November on Focal Press. And the other thing I'm going to do is give a keynote talk at the upcoming AES Headphone Conference, which is in Helsinki in August. So if you're really into headphones, that's the conference you should attend.
Oh, yeah. And Helsinki is such a great city. I worked for a Finnish company for a long time, and it was always fun to go over there to Helsinki and hang out and maybe have a glass or two of Salmi, and of course some sauna as well. Sauna is mandatory in Finland. It's very good for you. I have one more question for you there, Sean. You've taken us through your career, some of the great innovations, some of your future plans, some of the things we will be listening out for over the next years. But I'd love for you to choose a track for our VIP title playlist. So everyone from Carl Cox to A.R. Rahman has chosen a track for this, and now it's your fourth turn. So what's going to go in the playlist?
Yeah, so getting back to my roots as a musician, I'm going to recommend a CD that came out on Deutsche Grammophon. I think it was 2023. It's Bach Goldberg Variations. And the pianist is an Icelandic guy named Víkingur Ólafsson.
Fantastic.
I think he's like 40, 41. He's like a Nordic version of Glenn Gould in the sense that he has incredible technique. And he reinterprets these in a way that's very compelling. And I also read about him last night. He has perfect pitch, and he has this rare thing called synesthesia, where he sees colors when he plays in different keys.
That is just superb, Sean. Thank you. I will be absolutely adding that to my stack of CDs next to the hi-fi downstairs. So listen, Sean, thank you so much for joining us again for a record-breaking fourth time on the Audio Talks podcast. It has been absolutely great to catch up with you, and best wishes for the years ahead.
Oh, thank you very much. It's my pleasure. And I only have fond memories of our times together in various places across the world.
Oh, phenomenal. Well, right back at you there, Sean. I am going to be absolutely smashing the subscribe button on all of your socials. I'll be keeping in touch with you, and I look forward to catching up again and hearing about your progress with the holodeck and the headphone research that you mentioned yet. So I'll be making the live long and prosper sign to try and switch it on, obviously. So listen, that wraps up our conversation with a true great, Dr. Sean Olive, a genuine innovator whose work continues to shape the way that we all experience music and sound. As Dr. Sean embarks on a very well-earned retirement, the entire team at Audio Talks and at Harman and the broader audio community will continue to commemorate a career that has truly changed the way that the world listens. Sean's legacy is going to continue to resonate in every Harman product and in every headphone that delivers sound the way it was meant to be heard. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share with your fellow audio enthusiasts. Until next time, keep listening. Take care.